You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a bright, beautiful, sunny Davis day. And I get to say that forever until fall, don't I, Don?
Well, we get clouds occasionally between the middle of May and the middle of October, but not very often. We get rain, so intermittently, so rarely during those time periods that I think it's safe to say that the probability of your ability to say that over the next several weeks is very, very high. We are having gorgeous weather in Northern California. I hate to editorialize about the weather, but who can argue with highs in the low 80s, nights in the 50s for the next week?
That's pretty,
that's pretty perfect for everything. So Lois and I,
we've had highs in the 70s, and then we'll have highs in the low 90s, and then we'll have high 80s. We're doing that little flutter.
We've already done that. We were in the 90s 5 days ago, and then day before yesterday, Lois and I, thank you to the listener who always reminds me that we need to do this. We're preparing this broadcast on May 14th for broadcast on May 15th, 2025. And the high today is going to be 78 degrees. 5 days ago, it was 94 degrees. 5 days ago? Yeah. And then 2 days ago, it got to the bare mid-60s and it actually rained on us. And the night temperature was 46 degrees. So today's high is going to be 78. Thursday, the day of the broadcast, 83 degrees and sunny. Thursday night, 54, partly cloudy. Friday, 84 degrees and sunny. Friday night, 52 degrees, partly cloudy. Saturday, 76 degrees and mostly sunny. Every nursery professional who just heard that is going, oh my God, we're going to be busy. Saturday night, 52 degrees, mostly clear. Sunday, 78 degrees and sunny. So the rest of this week and through the weekend, mid 70s. And then Monday, 87. Monday night, 59, and Tuesday, 90. I did look at the long-range forecast over at one of the commercial sites, and it looks like we'll be into the mid-90s, mid to late part of next week, and then a little cooling trend again after that, at least is what they're looking at. So temperatures in the 80s, which is absolutely perfect planting weather for summer vegetables and all kinds of flowers and shrubs and trees and things like that. And then we're going to warm up, so keep a close watch on the watering. But it looks like pretty good weather right now for all those things you want to get in the ground. So maybe this is a good weekend to do that project. KDRT is community radio. That's public radio. We rely on contributions from listeners like you to fund our operating costs. And we thank you all who donated during our fund drive. If you didn't happen to get a chance to do that, you still can. Let's see, kdrt.org/donate. kdrt.org/donate. You can still go in there and send us a contribution. Thanks to you who donate. Thanks for listening. Thanks for your future donations to keep KDRT on the air. Let's do one of those public service announcement things.
Well, I would have, but I just closed that window. I am so afraid. Do you happen to remember Patricia's dates?
Hold everything. Got them right here. Hold on. Yes, we're all.
This is a real show, folks. You know, yes. This at home.
That's right. We don't rehearse in advance. Patricia Carpenter.
But then I closed the wrong button.
Patricia Carpenter is having one of her open garden rambles. Patricia is an ambassador for the California Native Plant Society. Has a remarkable collection of California native plants on her property out west of town. She comments, the majority of the tours featuring native gardens are held in April, when many flowers bloom. Have you ever wondered what happens after the peak bloom or super bloom? Still plenty of flowers. Late season shrubs blooming, pipe vine caterpillars galore, desert plants starting to bloom. Many geophytes bloom late in the spring season. Quick, Lois, what's a geophyte?
Oh, that's a plant that has a root-like thing.
Yeah, bulb-like thing, some kind of bulb structure, bulb corm, rhizome, that kind of thing. She's got a lovely picture of a pink fairy duster on this note. The next one is Sunday, May 18th. Come anytime between 9 a.m. and 2 p.m., rain or shine. You can go to cnps.org. That's the California Native Plant Society, cnps.org. Click on the events link and you'll find information about this and a map, which I think would be rather important. And on this late spring ramble, Glenn Holstein is a botanist who will be joining them, helping with plant ID, answering questions about native plants. He is a wildflower enthusiast. And you're also welcome to photograph, find a shady spot to paint or draw, or even write a poem. Mobile Nursery Miraday will be there again. So all kinds of stuff going on there. And they'll actually be sharing some native seeds. Patricia Carpenter's Native Plant Ramble out west of Davis. Go to cnps.org and click on the event link.
And when you get that flyer, I want you to look at the picture because this is an incredibly beautiful picture of a California wildflower that is, you know, it blooms in the foothills. It isn't down here in the valley.
Right.
But Don, Tritolea, doesn't it have a used to have a different name, Brodia? Wasn't it Brodia?
It's gone through multiple name changes over the years. Yes. Botanists have been having a lot of fun with that one. Yeah. Yeah,
Okay.
Patricia's garden, just so you know, is a collection of native plants. It's very artistically arranged and all that kind of thing. And she also has a very big garden of, you know, other things too. It's not a wildlife restoration, a wildland restoration. You're not going in there and seeing the things that would have been native on that site. It's a great reference collection of California native plants from other parts, other plant communities, as well as our own. Here in the Davis area and all around Davis Woodland, we are in the Valley Grassland plant community. If you're doing a wildland restoration here, it would feature mostly clump grasses, perennial grasses, some herbaceous wildflowers, and here and there would be a lovely stately valley oak. If you're right along the creek, you'd have the riparian plants. No, this is a collection of plants from other plant communities as well, the oak woodland plant communities and the foothill areas and so forth. So you can come and get some ideas, even if you don't happen to reside in this particular plant community.
All right, we do have some announcements, and one is the Thursday Zoom show. I lost it, Don. Okay, so we have been announcing the Thursday show, and Don's going to get this up soon and tell you about vermiculture and all that stuff. But I called Jennifer Baumbach, who is with UCANR. That's over at the university, and said, "Okay, we have this announcement sheet, but it doesn't give people enough information. How can they get information?" And she said, "The public can contact me at," and gave me her phone number and her email address over on campus, because those are the public things. And then they also have a Master Gardener helpline if you need help when we're not on the air. So, Don, how much of this do you want me to say right now? I'm putting them on the spot.
Everybody get your pen and pencil and paper handy. Okay,
No, just come and look at the archives. You know where the archives are,
Lois is
right?
going to read off one of them.
J M B A U M B A C H at UCANR dot EDU.
Great. That's
That's
written.
Jennifer Baumbach.
Okay, information about these ongoing Zoom workshops and the one coming up this weekend. Let's see, well, January 20, May 22nd, which is actually not on the weekend. Which day of the week is that? Let me double check.
Thursday. They're all Thursday now.
Thank you. Janet Arias will be talking about vermicomposting. What is vermicomposting? Well, that is using worms to recycle your food scraps into nutrient-rich worm castings, which are great. They are the gold standard of soil amendments. And I can tell you, as someone who sells them, they're priced accordingly. Learn how to set up and maintain a worm bin, how to harvest and use these worm castings in your garden. A fun project for kids, also great for gardeners who just want to give their plants an extra boost. So that's May 22nd. Learn about vermicomposting. I remember speaking to someone who raised worms and sold us worm castings as well as worm casting-based potting soils years ago. They pretty consistently would test worm castings at 3% nitrogen, which puts them close to chicken manure in terms of the nitrogen content. And it was a steady release over a 1 to 2 year period, is my recollection from looking at manure release curves fascinating subject. Bring it up at the next party you go to. And so worm castings have a high nitrogen content, and yet it's gentle. But more to the point, they're dense. They're like soil. I mean, the worms eat this stuff and poop it out, and the poop is soil-like. And so the worm castings can be a great thing to add to, for example, a large container when you're doing things in barrels or large tubs and you're using light, fluffy potting soil that you purchased or you've made your own, you've got a lot of compost in there. You can mitigate the fast drainage and enhance the moisture retention and nutrient retention by adding worm castings. So not only do they provide nutrients directly, they help retain nutrients and help retain moisture. You got to be cautious not to use too much, but for a container use, worm castings can be great, except that a little bag of worm castings is more than $20. So making your own, easy to do, fun to learn about it. May 22nd, vermicomposting. Thanks to the Yolo County Master Gardeners for these Zoom workshops.
I want to talk more about worms, Don.
Okay.
Because back in the 70s and 80s, when I was in college, people were getting big into vermiculture, which is worm ranching, basically.
Yeah.
And you know, they don't smell. You can't compost things in your house. Yeah. Well, with the worms, they don't smell.
Yes, this is one source of manure that does not carry an undesirable odor with it.
And you can do it in the house. In fact, I think it's a little better in the house, because if you're keeping them contained in a bucket, which is how most people do that, you don't want to put it outside because it would get too hot or too cold or whatever. But here's the cool thing about worms. You can do worm farming outdoors. You just have worms in your soil, and they're eating and they're pooping and they're producing all this wonderful expensive stuff for free in your ground. It's wonderful.
Another point is that people come in regularly to ask us if we sell worms, and we don't. We've given up on selling living things like worms and ladybugs because there's a really high mortality rate on it. More to the point, you don't need to buy them. I suggest in any situation, at least locally, and my guess is there's a lot of places where this is true, you want to see if you have worms in your soil, just take a whole bunch of leaves or ground up stuff from your vegetable garden, stuff you would compost, pile it over in a lightly shaded corner, start sprinkling it down overhead, don't drown the area, and go out and rake those leaves back 2 to 3 weeks later, and I'm sure you're going to find worms there. They'll migrate up from deeper in the soil or over from drier, hotter areas. They like moisture. They like light shade. They like the cooler soil. We have loads of worms in our soil. It's interesting to speak to worm experts, once again, because of where my nursery is. I have people who have advanced expertise in these topics who will share it with me. Most of the worms you're finding are not actually native, but they're beneficial anyway, and they are already there. They're already present. So you have almost no need to go out and buy worms. There may be places people are listening where the soil has been treated, stripped off, who knows what, that it might be beneficial to add them. I would inquire locally from an actual expert, not just someone who's selling worms, but it's really easy to find out, because if you just pile stuff up and leave it undisturbed, various organisms will move in there. In fact, in my yard right now, in those kinds of leaf piles, I go out every morning, and the skunks have visited again during the night to scratch away through those leaves and find the worms and eat them. So I know that in raising worms, I'm contributing to the whole cycle of life here on my farm. You probably have worms already on your property. You don't need to buy them, but it's easy enough to figure that out. Anyway, May 22nd, vermicomposting. And in June, they'll talk about beginning plant propagation. So we'll talk about that one as we get closer to that event.
All right. So that's lots of stuff that's happening. I wanted to talk about, are people able to listen to our show after it is broadcast live? The broadcast is local, like just in Davis, but it also streams at the same time. So when it broadcasts, it also streams.
Thursdays noon to one. Yep.
Yep. And then it restreams on Saturday at 9 o'clock. But any other time, you can come to the station's website, kdrt.org, and you can look for our archives for the Davis Garden Show. Or if you are the kind of person who wants to get it downloaded directly to you, you can click on that little link that says RSS on the station's website, and that will set up your new RSS feed for you. If you're doing it the old-fashioned way and you're going through Apple, well, we started podcasting to Apple before the station started doing their thing. And so If you got it that way, you're getting Apple Podcasts, and that means Don has to upload them to Apple before you can see them. So if you ever go there on a Friday and go, well, it's Friday, it's the day after, he should have, well, maybe he didn't. So
you'll find it. There's one other simple thing is just to go to davisgardenshow.com, and there are also right there, and you can click directly on them. But there are actually two parallel podcast sources out there and have been essentially from the start. The one I do at davisgardenshow.com, which is the one the podcast directories use, and the one that is through kdrt.org at the show page, and you can click on that one. And so we're there. Sometimes I'm late. Sometimes I don't get around to things as quickly as I should. I do thank you all when you bring this to my attention, because sometimes I've made a mistake and I can go in and correct that. So when you don't see a podcast there or there's something wrong with it, yes, sending a note to davisgardenshow@gmail.com is very, very helpful. You're not bothering us at all. You're helping everybody. Thank you.
So, Don, I have in front of me a document. It says Tomato Time 2025.docx. Is this something that's on your website?
In one form or another, but if you go to redwoodbarn.com and type tomato into the little search box, you're going to be overwhelmed, because I've written a lot of things about tomatoes. Well, we're at a stage of the season right now where people are either buying tomatoes, they're asking us questions about which ones to plant, or they've planted them and they want to know what to do next. Now, we're not going to do a whole show or even a long segment on tomatoes today, but we're going to focus on two things briefly: what to do now and quick overview of which ones I did last year that just gave ridiculous numbers of fruit.
Okay. Before we do that, Don's going to ask me some questions. These are just basic tomato questions, and I'll give you the answer. One word answer. Go ahead, Don.
Do they need to be pruned?
No.
Okay, we'll talk a little bit more about that. Do they need bees?
No, actually, they're self-pollinated.
Do high temperatures affect the yield?
On some varieties, yes. On most varieties, when it gets really high. So your mileage may vary.
Yes, very good. And it will vary from one variety to another in different parts of the country. There's a couple of varieties I don't sell here. I could sell the heck out of Brandywine if I would just keep my mouth shut and not tell people it doesn't yield well here. And here's, let's do the last one here, and then we'll go back to a couple of those. Which variety tastes best? It's funny when people ask me that. So,
well, it depends on your mouth.
Yes, indeed.
I mean, some people like them when they're really sharpened and astringent, I think is the term Don uses.
They have high acidity.
High tomato taste. And some people like them when they're mellow and mild and they melt in your mouth and they're all sweet and tomatoey.
Tastes differ. The short answer to this is that tastes differ with respect to acidity and sweetness. And what you were raised on, by the way, is probably your preference. If you're raised on canned or jarred products, they add a lot of sugar to those, just for the record. I mean, the whole process of developing ketchup and tomato sauces for the American palate over 100 years ago involved adding sugar and vinegar to what they were producing, because that was what people responded well to. But people vary with respect to acidity and sweetness primarily. To me, a good tomato is one that has a balance of those things. But I do have customers who prefer only on the sweet end and what they call low acid. Don't count on low acidity in the sense of, you know, titratable acidity, but in flavor, some of them are sweeter and less acidic tasting. And some people think those are more digestible. So it's really very much a personal preference. If someone asks me, as someone did, well, what's the best tomato? My reply is, what do you like to do with your tomatoes? Because then I can answer your question with a little more detail. So let's back up to a couple of
them. We have two more questions that I want to answer. Okay, ask and answer.
Ask and answer. There you go.
Are tomatoes poisonous? No. They're in the same group as some plants that have, what is it, a solanine?
Solanine, and yeah, tomatine and solanine are present. Tomatine is very low toxicity. It's what's in tomato foliage. People used to think tomato foliage was poisonous. No, it's not. Solanine, which is in other members of the family, the nightshade family, is poisonous. It's not what's in tomato foliage. There are very poisonous members of the family, but no, tomatoes are not poisonous. Of course, they were widely believed to be for many, many years in Europe, and different countries caught on to the fact that they weren't at different times. The Spaniards figured it out about 200 years before the Italians, but both did great things with tomatoes once they figured it out, let me tell you.
And then the last thing is about the plant itself. Mm-hmm. Because sometimes you'll see it talked about as a vine. Sometimes it's a bush. Sometimes it's just a plant. It's not a perennial because it's a subtropical and it would get too cold here
So
for
to
it to
say, to
get
rephrase
over.
that, it is a perennial unless it gets frozen. So many, many plants we grow in our garden, petunias, which are closely related to tomatoes, are things that will continue to grow for 2 or 3 years if they don't freeze. San Diego, places like that, tomatoes routinely go through the winter, as do petunias and things like that. So technically, and I learned this phrase from Burpee Seed Catalog way, way, way back when I was a teenager and ordering seeds. A tomato is a tender perennial grown as an annual. So it's
Okay, and there we go.
perennial
And
from
that's our
places where it doesn't freeze, but we're of course growing tomatoes all over the world in places where it does freeze. And it's not a
okay.
vine. It grows, we should treat it like a vine unless you want a massive ground cover of tomatoes because they will run across the ground. It's not a shrub. It's essentially a ground cover, if you will. But most people who are growing tomatoes quickly learn there's advantages to staking them up. So
So
what's
when you if they would grow, run across the ground, why wouldn't they climb up on something?
Well, they will. I've
Like
intentionally
a
planted,
trellis, maybe?
sure. I've intentionally planted tomatoes at times just to see, what they do when you don't do any kind of training or staking on them, which is kind of fun. Each plant takes up about a 6 foot diameter circle, at least, of solid foliage as a ground cover plant. And it fruits just fine, by the way, just same amount of fruit. The only problem is all the fruit is a couple inches above the soil. So anything that likes tomatoes, which is lots of things, can climb up there and get into it. You'll get a lot of problems with sow bugs and earwigs and things just climbing up and eating the fruit as it ripens on the ground, not to mention the squirrels, which will think you've done them a huge favor. So we always stake them up off the ground, just mainly one for convenience and to take up less space and to reduce the loss of fruit to spoilage and to attack by all the many, many things in your yard that like to eat tomatoes,
Including you.
including you. Yes. And it's really a hassle to pick tomatoes off the ground, let me tell you. When our kids are
Well, it's
16,
hard to get in there without stepping on
I'm
them.
going to tell you an old guy story. Our kids are 16 months apart in age. Okay. So when we had the second one, there was a period when we had, a 3-year-old and a 1-year-old. We planted 50 tomato plants that year. We were ambitious. We were going to can and do everything. But because of how busy we were, we never got around to staking or caging the 50
Oops.
tomato plants. Now, they were planted 3 to 4 feet apart. They were planted with enough room for stakes and cages. So if you do the math there, each plant had 10 square feet, 50 plants, all uncaged. So we ended up with a massive ground cover of mixed varieties of tomatoes. And it is true that at any time in the summer, you could go out there and carefully and gingerly step through this mass of tomatoes and pick an entire basket of extraordinary range of varieties. And they were very, very productive, but it was gross. So I highly, highly recommend putting a cage on at the time you plant the plant. So that gets us to the first brief topic on tomatoes, which is get them up off the ground somehow. How do I stay a cage or stake mine? I use concrete wire. I want to mention this is heavy duty stuff. It's a two-person job when you first make them, and it's kind of dangerous because you're cutting this stuff and there's sharp ends on the wire. So this is something that requires supervision. But I have made now 30 6 foot tomato cages out of 6 inch grid concrete wire, which I can just stack up from year to year because I'm out in the country. They're also bulky, so this is not convenient for a lot of people, but they have lasted. Some of these are more than 25 years old. They hold up well. I put a heavy metal tri-stake in the ground. I put the cage over the plant at the time of planting. It's not a I'm going to come back and do this later thing at the time of planting. It looks so cute with this little 5 inch tomato down there in the bottom of a 6 inch cage. It's a true, true. Truly, to me, the sign that gardeners are eternally optimistic. And then I attach that very securely to the stake because we get a lot of wind here. Just in the last 2 weeks, we've had wind storms from the north and the south that would have taken over a tomato cage with no problem. So I securely stake them to a metal tri-stake. And a typical tomato will fill that 6 foot cage by end of June and be out the top and going out the sides and all the way back to the ground by the end of the summer. That's an indeterminate normal tomato. Determinate types, bush types, dwarf indeterminate, these new ones that are more compact will certainly fill the cage. In our climate, even those will fill the cage with no problem. For those of you that don't want to wrestle with concrete wire, I have found that the woven wire that you can get that's made for fencing usually comes 4 foot high. It works reasonably well. 4 foot's better than no foot. You know, 4 foot's better than those cute little tomato cages that nurseries like to sell. So if you want something that's manageable, 4 foot welded wire, make sure the holes are big enough to get your hand through. I learned that the hard way. Make sure the holes are big enough to get your hand in and pull out a large tomato. Let's put it that way. So if you got a 1 pound tomato in there, you don't want to be trying to reach over the top or under from the bottom. You want to be able to get your hand through there. That's what I do. What my father did was he'd get 6 foot wooden stakes. He'd put one or two next to each plant. He'd tie them up until they got to the top. And that would be that. And this is in San Diego, where you could plant in January and they'd grow till December. By 2 months into the season, they were over the top of that and just going all over the place. So it's a workable system, but they still grow too big for that to keep them completely off the ground. I have seen any of a number of other methods for staking, caging, training. They can work on a trellis. You can pretend they're a vine, train them on a fence, whatever you want to do. The key is to get them up off the ground with whatever works for you. The only thing I would say is those commercial tomato cages that you buy aren't big enough for any tomatoes that we sell. So they're great for peppers, eggplant, dahlias, peonies, things like that. They really aren't big enough for tomatoes in general.
If I had a wall on my house that faced west, so it would get sunshine hottest part of the day, would it be a good idea to put a wire thing hanging from the roof and down that wall and let
train it up on that? You could do that. The west exposure concerns me a little bit because of the possibility of sun scald on the fruit, which would be more of an issue with bigger fruited types. So I would choose your variety carefully for that. We get in the Sacramento Valley, and I would anecdotally say this seems to be increasing for some reason, we get sunburn on tomato fruit when we have a heat wave as they're ripening. And it's particularly a problem with bigger fruited ones. And then you've waited and your 1 pound tomato is just getting ready. And then we have a July heat wave and it gets 106 degrees. And the entire west side of the fruit gets scalded, burnt. I mean, it damages the tissue. If you see that and catch it in time, you can harvest, you can cut out the good portion and use it. If you don't, it spoils. And that's a big frustration here with bigger fruited types. If you were doing what you propose, I would use a cherry tomato, or a yellow pear tomato, or one of the current tomatoes. I would use a smaller fruited type. Even if some of the fruit sunburned, the yield is so high, the loss of fruit during a brief extreme heat episode would be a trivial percentage of your crop. So I wouldn't do your big slicing tomato that way. But yes, you could put it on a west-facing wall.
So you know those little paper bags that you get at One Cookie in? They're very small, mm-hmm. They're flat.
They're number four sandwich bag, yep.
Exactly. Yes. So what about if I keep a set of those around, sure, and some clothes pins, and then on the day when it's going to be really hot, when you're going to have a heat wave, I could just clip this to the stem and let that shade the tomato. Would that work? Is it the heat that hurts it?
Congratulations. You're already embarking on the obsessive tomato growers fascination with gadgets. And I think you've got a good one. Number four sandwich bags are pretty cheap, and clothespins are something you can still find at stores. Do people still use them? Sure. And that would be one way to protect an individual fruit, especially let's say you're growing like, you know, pineapple, a 1 pound heirloom that only produces 8 fruit and you really wanted to get fully vine ripe. You could do that. The other thing though, that you can do, and we say this over and over again, if it's got any color to it, if it's gone from green to off green, and it's breaker stage, as they call it, and you know that there's going to be extreme heat in the next few days, pick that one and put it on your counter and let it ripen there. And someone said, but will it be as good as one that vine ripens? It won't be burnt. So
it'll be better.
It'll be better in that regard. Yes. And we never know whether this is the heat wave that's going to cause the sunburn. So you should understand that, you know, as soon as a tomato goes off of dark green, once it's gone to the breaker stage, it will progress through ripening. It's a climacteric fruit, and there's a provable, observable process of 7 to 8 days of ripening from that breaker stage that is used, thankfully, to get tomatoes to the grocery store. Yours will be better than that. They will be homegrown and they will still have very rich flavor and they won't be burnt. So the answer is to pick the fruit if you have to because of an extreme heat. Now, I'm talking about temperatures in the hundreds, not temperatures in the 90s. People get, well, as soon as we hit 90 degrees here, a lot of people who are new to this area, you know, think that's too extreme for tomatoes. It is not too extreme for tomatoes at all. But if it's 110, yeah, that's going to fry some fruit. But smaller fruited ones generally are so productive, that's not a big issue. The main thing is stick them up off the ground. The two other questions I'm getting most commonly, do I need to fertilize them? I put some kind of fertilizer in at the time of planting by the simple process I go through of transplanting them into 1 gallon containers in enriched soil. That has enough nutrients in it that that provides what they need. I do find tomatoes and peppers and eggplant in particular, all of those three benefit from some light nitrogen feeding early in their growth cycle. Peppers, keep feeding them if you want to, and you'll get great results. Tomatoes, keep feeding them, and you'll get giant vines. So we suggest feeding at the time of planting with whatever you prefer, or if you've planted already, they're in the ground, it's been a couple of weeks, go ahead and mix up something like fish emulsion, works great. It's 5% nitrogen, things like that, or an organic fertilizer, which will feed for a longer period, or a conventional fertilizer, just follow the label directions, some source of nitrogen early in the season. Guy came in who'd had a whole soil test done. It indicated a slight deficiency in potassium. He wanted to know where to get potassium. I said, one, don't worry about that too much, but every fertilizer that we sell you has some potassium in it and takes care of that. You don't need a certain percentage of potassium in the fertilizer. Just get general, focus on nitrogen, gentle nitrogen early in the season. Generally, that's it. Exception. If you're using a raised planter and you filled it with a topsoil you bought from one of our local topsoil vendors, that's really sandy and doesn't hold nutrients well. So generally people who do that find that, especially in the early years of using that soil before they've had a chance to enrich it and build it, adding something that keeps feeding through the season is helpful. You can buy a bagged product that's got some chicken manure or something in it, cultivate that in. You can use earthworm castings, they're particularly rich. You can feed again with liquid fertilizer every now and then, but be really cautious about overfeeding tomatoes because it leads to growth and not necessarily better yield. So that's the main thing about feeding them. Then the watering, and I've already had this conversation once. The drip system in her yard was running twice a week for 20 minutes.
It's not enough.
Mm-mm. Not anywhere near enough. And I said, try 2 hours. And I got the facial expression that I always get when I say that.
Oh, no. but folks, think about it this way. If you had left it on a sprinkler system, a normal regular sprinkler system, and you ran it for 20 minutes, you would have been in lots of water.
Yeah.
Compare how much water comes out of a sprinkler and how much comes out of a drip. Your drip is like 1/100th?
It's maybe in that range, yeah. So yeah, a sprinkler is gallons per minute and an emitter is gallons per hour. So that's one way to look at it. And the most common that's being put in by landscapers these days is a brand Netafim or a similar brand out there, which have emitters in the tubing. All right, so they're emitterized tubing, as they call it. And the most popular that they're putting out is 0.4 gallons per hour. Okay, there's 128 ounces in a gallon. So this is putting out less than half of that in an hour. So it's putting out less than 60 ounces in an hour. And they're only running it for 20 minutes. So they're getting 20 ounces of water. How many coffee cups of water is that? That's not enough to sustain a tomato plant. Certainly not 2 times a week. That was what the landscaper said it at. And I said, well, what I want you to do, and I can tell you, I'll have this conversation again many, many, many times. So go home and just turn it on, go to the valve, turn on the knob and let it run, I don't know, all afternoon and watch what happens. Watch whether the water soaks in or runs off. Watch the distribution of the water. You're only doing this once. You're just testing it. You're also, by the way, hydrating the surrounding soil for these new plants. You're going way past the root zone that's there now, but roots won't grow into dry soil. So you're hydrating the soil that they're going to be growing into. And let me tell you, tomato roots grow very fast, as do melon roots, as do other bigger summer vegetables. And so after you've done that, go out the next day with your trowel or your 18-inch screwdriver or whatever you have chosen for your monitoring method and start digging around and see how the moisture distributed. And that'll tell you whether you got the whole thing hydrated. My own experience is, your mileage may vary, I rarely run a drip system less than 2 hours. Rarely. And I've got higher output emitters. I've got 2 gallon an hour emitters, but I have them on wider spacing. So I'm giving a tomato plant at least a couple of gallons, if not 4 gallons, each time I irrigate it. Every day, of course not. No, I can do it a couple times a week. And overall, during the course of the week, I may gradually get to where I'm doing it longer and less often, of course of the season, excuse me. The main thing is water deeply all at once. Check your soil, because your soil might be sandy, might be silty, might have lots of organic stuff in it. You may be listening in Minnesota. You may be listening in Arizona. You're going to have different outcomes. See how long you can go before you need to water again. Water deeply and less often if you possibly can. But the deeply part is the important part. Because if you only water shallowly, the roots can't grow into dry soil, and they won't. And that's when I get the pictures in early July, when we've had an early heat wave, and the poor plants are still, 2 feet tall and struggling, and they're flowering, the fruit are barely developing. And I say, go home and turn on your drip system, let it run all afternoon. we start the process all over again.
So 0.4 gallons.
That's a typical one, yeah.
Per hour.
Yeah.
So in order to get 2 gallons mm-hmm. on that plant, I would have to run that for 5 hours.
Right. Normally there's two of them close enough to the plant that you can figure it's getting water from both of them. Because usually these have the emitter every foot. So you're getting 2.5 hours instead of 5 hours. But yeah. That's not uncommon. Now, I know people who do raised beds and who have brought in soil and put in a drip system, and they find they have to run it every day because the soil they brought in drains very quickly. And they typically find they have to run it for 30 to 40 minutes a day. And they think that seems like a lot of water. We'll add that all up in the course of one day. No, it's 3.5 hours of water over the course of 1 week instead of the 2.5 that might be possible, but it's not that much more water than the rest of us are using. Part of the problem there is you've chosen a soil that drains so fast. So you just have to water more frequently because it doesn't retain moisture. Do whatever you can to help your soil retain moisture, which means mulch. Add compost on the surface. Add compost on the surface at the time of planting. Afterwards, that helps to shade the soil. And as it infiltrates in, it retains moisture. One other thing about that drip system. My friend Fred Hoffman, who moved from out in the country into town, had to do all raised planters when he moved into town. And for each 4x8 bed, he put in 4 lines of drip. And then he brought the fanciest soil he could buy from a local rock yard. 4 lines in that soil made 4 stripes of water. It didn't distribute enough. So he found 5 lines in a 4-foot-wide bed took care of that problem. You can either solve the problem with more emitters, you can solve the problem with another line, or you can solve the problem by running it longer. But if you just run it for a short interval and fast draining soil, your plants are going to have issues. Now, I adopted a technique when I had a raised planter at one house where I just ran the system, looked for the wet spots and put the plant right there. That worked pretty well, but even still, you had to run it a long time to get the whole root system watered. You need to water longer. And someone said to me, gosh, that's a lot of money. Water is really expensive.
That's
in the course of an entire summer, the water cost for one indeterminate tomato would be less than $5. Entire summer. We did the math. That's in Davis. Your results may vary because you may be paying more or less. We get hot. That was based on 10 gallons a week. And our current cost per CCF of water here would be less than $5 for that plant. I'll get you more precise, detailed information for you engineering folks out there so you know. But we're talking about a few bucks for one tomato plant to produce 20 to 40 pounds of tomatoes. I'll give you that as the round figure.
That's not a lot of water. Okay, let's move on. We said we were going to be really short in our tomato thing.
Yep.
And so I want to tell people how they can get these notes. You have the tomato 2024 season notes .doc.
Yep.
And that's on the website. Yes.
Sure.
All right. So people, write that down. Tomato 2024 season notes .doc.
If you want to know the top producer. In terms of normal sized tomatoes, weirdly enough, was Lemon Boy last year, at least 100, 150 fruit. And that was that's one that's like 4 to 6 ounce fruit. I mean, cherry tomatoes, I don't even count. I just do a rough estimate. So, and just for the record, I have set aside for planting this year, and about half of them are in the ground, 34 varieties that I'm testing. And I had already chosen 2 new cherry tomatoes. I'm not a huge fan of cherry tomatoes, but I like to see how they compare. I had chosen 2 new ones from Wild Boar Farms, Brad Gates. And then I asked the other household members, okay, what tomatoes do you guys want? And they apparently had some dispute about which cherry tomato they wanted. So there are 2 cherry tomatoes that they wanted. And so that's 4 cherry tomatoes that are going to be going into the ground here. Each cherry tomato, in our experience, produces several hundred fruit. So we're going to try something this year that gets back to that pruning question. We're going to try pruning a couple of them. Keep them smaller. Keep the plants in the cage. Keep them from running all over the place. Maybe we'll reduce the yield from 1,000 fruit to only 500. I think that'll probably be okay. We'll give you a report.
Well, Don, you just said that Lemon Boy was over 100?
Yeah.
Well, Your chart just says 100. Are you sure you gave me the newest chart?
Yeah, I stopped counting at some point. So I did my last count. Okay, let me see you understand. I did my last count the first week of October. And I went out in the first week of November to start cutting down and taking out the plants. And some of them had a whole nother batch. I mean, some of them had another 50 fruit or so on them. So these are the bottom end of the yield in terms of what they did. Lemon Boy is a very nice, sweet, mild, yellow tomato that makes a great sauce. And I do happen to highly recommend it. 2 years ago, my top fruiting tomato in the normal size range was Cherokee Purple, which has never been a super high yielder for me. So you never know from year to year exactly which one's going to do well. Be sure to diversify your portfolio as you choose your tomato varieties. Okay.
And one of the things to know is that some of these, like this one intrigues me, Sweet Carneros Pink.
Yeah.
And it said, oh, it grew vigorously, but it didn't send any fruit until August.
Yeah. And this was true.
But then it said dozens of fruit and you had lots of late fruit. Yeah. So if you're planting, if you have room for more than one tomato, you might get one that does really well in the early, really well in the fall.
Yeah.
You know,
a lot of varieties stop setting in July. Last July, July 2024, we had the whole month was hot. We had three heat waves in succession. The only two, there were like 3 days total in the month that were average temperatures. So needless to say, the average is going up. But we had significant number of days in the upper 90s to low hundreds. And in Sacramento, they broke a record on the number of days in 100 range. We weren't quite there, but it was high enough that they weren't pollinating. And so a lot of people's tomatoes kind of fizzled out. They basically got what had set in late May and June. And those ripened in late July and August. And then that was it. They weren't watering enough in most cases. And the heat took its toll. It also took its toll on pollination and therefore yield in September. But they did set heavily as we got into our normal August weather pattern where we do cool down. The August cool down is a phrase that a meteorologist in Sacramento used for many years. The weather pattern shifts. We get more influence from the Gulf of Mexico and so forth. And we have cooler weather. And we generally get very good fruit set here in early to mid-August. And those ripen 7 weeks later. So if you're listening in a place where your season ends on Labor Day, that won't do you any good. But if you're listening in a place like here where your season doesn't really end until Halloween, I had, as usual, very high yields in late September, early October. But you got to keep watering, even when it's hot, even when they don't seem to be setting. If you don't want to do that, and this will be the end of today's conversation, plant a determinate variety, water it well early, determinate ones grow to a certain size, flower, fruit, and they're done, basically. Roma, Principe Borghese, Ace are three good examples of determinate tomatoes with different styles. Then you're harvesting in late July. You cut the plant down. You've got room for your Brussels sprouts. So you can just deal with your tomatoes as if you're only growing them for processing, freezing, whatever. Those are two of those are very good for sun drying or freezing or sauce. Principe Borghese for sun drying and sauce. Ace is a great table tomato. It's really, really good. Great for slicing and all that kind of thing. Then you'll be done. If you don't happen to take them out, and you do keep them watered, they'll continue to yield some. Determinate tomatoes aren't just like a one and done thing, but they're mostly that way. They mostly yield all at once. If you leave them in, you'll keep picking. Another thing you can do is stick one more tomato in late. You know, it's June, go to your nursery where they might still have some plants. We will, I guarantee it. Stick one in late, water it well, you'll be harvesting from that one in October. Those are ways to minimize your water use by strategic planting and timing. So it is possible, even though it's only a few bucks to grow a tomato plant, it is possible to reduce even that by focusing on the earlier, the late part of the season.
I want to say the one word as we end, rugby. That was a big one, and it was a great producer, and everything is just looking up for rugby.
Yeah, the breeders are really focusing on some of these sauce tomatoes, and I think that's great, because if they're big enough, like rugby is a 6 or 7 ounce fruit, you can slice it too. It's intended for sauce, but you can slice it. Okay,
let's move on. I think that's enough tomato stuff. So far today I have explained, he sends me a note and tells me this. I haven't read it before, so this is free. Soil infiltration rate, nutrition retention, moisture retention, the rate of availability of nitrogen in different fertilizers, alternate bearing of citrus, risk of Phytophthora, crown and root rot, infection due to burying the stem or trunk of a citrus tree, irrigation frequency and duration needed as we get into summer, why running a drip system for 20 minutes twice a week isn't enough.
Yeah, that was Saturday morning. Saturday morning before 10 o'clock. So I thought I would just jot those down. It's kind of amazing the range of questions that we get. But you notice how many of them focus on soils, nutrition, and watering. And those are, if you're moving to the West from a place where it rains, those are the most important things you're going to learn about. Successful gardeners in the Sacramento Valley of California are the ones who have figured out how to water. That's the bottom line. So, but the next one, I want you to read this carefully, and we're not making fun of this person, but this is a not infrequent occurrence at my nursery. So
they came in and they had a bag.
Yep.
I'm using this, and they pulled neem oil out of the bag. Yep. And this, pulling out a 3-in-1 rose combination. I assume this is to be planted. And this, pulling out some snail bait. And something is still eating my peppers and basil. Uh-huh.
Yeah. So we call this ready, fire, aim. So without knowing what the pest was, this person had already used 3 different pesticides on it.
A 3-in-1 rose is a pesticide?
Yes. It's fertilizer combined with an insecticide and a fungicide. And the insecticide is
a rose bush.
And the insecticide is a systemic. So they had treated pepper plants with neem, which is fine. It's low toxicity, and a insecticide and a fungicide. And the insecticide is systemic. So it's now in the plant, and they've given it a fertilizer. Okay. And then put some snail bait out. Well, snail bait nowadays is usually just iron phosphate. It was pretty clear from the picture that they had earwigs. Earwigs show up here in late April, and they're a major pest through May, and they do feed on young seedlings, and they especially like some things like peppers and eggplant. Identify your pest before you apply a product. Fundamental principle of integrated pest management, and that is the key philosophy for dealing with pests. Number one, identify your pest. 2, monitor it. 3, choose the least toxic alternative that will manage the pest or change aspects of the environment that are encouraging the pest. So we focus on non-chemical methods first, changing something that's causing you to have a lot of earwigs in that area, or you go to the least toxic alternative. Now, of the 3 things that were brought out, the one that would have worked if they had purchased a particular version of snail bait would be the snail bait iron phosphate, to which the manufacturer has added spinosad, which is an organic insecticide. And that one actually has earwigs on the label. Whereas the one that doesn't have earwigs on the label is just iron phosphate and only kills snails and slugs. So I don't want to make fun of this person, but going into your garage and finding the pesticides you already have and applying them without knowing what you're spraying for is definitely not the way to go about it. You've now treated your peppers with a systemic insecticide. So that's now in the plant. Now, admittedly, it's the same one that's in peppers you buy in the grocery store. Nothing unusual about that, but you didn't follow the label directions. And you also treated it with a fungicide unnecessarily. And I don't even remember which fungicide they're using nowadays in these multiple combination products for roses. They're for roses. They're not intended for edible plants. So before you apply any product, read the label. Make sure that the crop you're applying it to is on the label. Make sure the pest that you're applying it for is on the label and follow the directions. And yes, we're always happy to answer these questions before you do it, because in many cases we'll say, earwigs are usually a problem when the plant is near their den. Their den is usually someplace where you have wood or something stacked up, or you've got some old nursery flats there. And if you clean that all out, you might find that they just disperse because you've made it more open around where they are. Also, you can go out at night to make sure of what is feeding on your plant, which I really highly recommend. I know that sounds funny, but take a flashlight and go out in the middle of the night, check. And if you're wearing a glove and you find 8 earwigs on each plant, which is what usually happens when you see these levels of damage, a whole bunch of them, you've got a den nearby. With the glove on, squeeze the earwig. You'll kill it if you can bring yourself to do that. If you can't, well, okay, tap them into a bowl of soapy water or something like that. But you can kill them mechanically. And they do have a season. They have about a 4 to 6 week period when they're coming out from their dens at night, going to the nearest plants. So they're on this side of the garden, not that side of the garden. You've got a den somewhere nearby. And they're feeding on the young seedlings. They're making holes in the leaves. I've never seen them kill a pepper plant. I've never seen them kill a tomato plant. I have seen them kill marigold plants. They seem to really like those. But you go out and you find them and you kill them directly. And you'll be surprised how effective that is. I know it's gross to squeeze something that has this claw-like thing on the back. So if you can't bring yourself to do that, a bowl of soapy water can be helpful. But the main point is, pesticides should be your last option, not your first option. And in most cases, you won't need them at all. And also, as we get to the end of May, earwigs then disperse. That's when you start finding them coming in your garage or trying to come in the house because the females are trying to find a place to make their next den for next year. And so cleaning things out nearby is helpful, but monitoring in particular, correctly identifying and resorting to a pesticide only when nothing else is working.
So I know, absolutely know, that there are going to be folks out there who said, well, my neighbor used snail bait and it got rid of the problem.
Could be.
And they didn't, because we're talking about a timed thing, okay? They come in April, they leave the end of May. Now, if you go out and you use something that doesn't work, and the earwigs are at the time when they're leaving, you may incorrectly assume that what you did caused the thing that happened. And it would have happened anyway. So be careful when you are listening to your neighbor say, I use this thing and it fixed that problem. Understand what the problem is and what would have happened anyway. Because in the case of earwigs, well, they disappear.
They'll run their course. I mean, they're usually not that bad. There are years when they're worse than others. We've had outbreaks of them here on our farm where they do more damage to the young seedlings, and I just squish as many at night as I can. But more to the point, the plant will outgrow it because their season is limited. Most pest problems have a 2 to 6 week cycle. This has been my observation. So something to try. I would love it if people would stop going around trying to find rose systemics, for example, and just see what happens if you don't spray or treat the aphids on your roses. And you know what? They tend to go away on their own because things come along and feed on them. So if that isn't happening, we can talk about why. We can talk about how you could make your yard more hospitable to the things that would feed on those aphids or reduce the likelihood of earwigs being a big problem in your vegetable garden bed. But going to a pesticide first, regrettably, that was the standard practice for, well, let's say about 1940. To about 20 years ago, you'd go to a nursery, you'd say you had a pest problem, you'd walk out with a pesticide. And when I would do consultations, which I used to do, I don't do them anymore. When I would do consultations and there'd be some problem going on in the yard, I would say, I'd be happy to look at what you already have and see if you have something that will work. And that was a real eye-opener to me to see what people had purchased and stockpiled in their garage in terms of pesticides, because they'd gone into a garden center or hardware store and said, I have this problem. They'd walked out with a full 16-ounce bottle of Malathion for a one treatment of aphids. I quickly, as a retailer, shifted over to the ready-to-use products because I saw amazing amount of stuff in people's garages they were never going to use. It was just going to end up at the dump. And the ready-to-use products, you use it, you're done, you dispose of it properly, you aren't accumulating things that are going to have to, your estate is going to have to deal with 20 years later because they're sitting in your garage. So I did once go to a retail seminar in the 80s where the statement was made, if they have a problem, they should leave with a product. And I thought to myself at that time, I do not agree with that. If they have a problem, they should leave with information. And if that information leads to a product, great. And it should be the least toxic product. But there's a lot of places where you go in. Please understand, pesticides on a profit per square foot basis are very, very good things for garden centers and hardware stores. There's a high likelihood that you walk in with a problem, you're going to buy a product and go out with it. Many people want to read the label in the store. We would prefer that you not do that because that means you've opened it up and you've torn apart the package. You can go online and every product label is online in a PDF form. So if you're looking at something, take a picture of it, ask first, take a picture of it, go home, type that into your Google search box, and up will come from some source, whether it's a company that sells them or the manufacturer themselves, the product label. Read that. Then read the MSD sheet. Read that. There's been a recent discussion about weed management on Nextdoor where someone jumped in and said, we use 30% acetic acid. And I just say, please go read the manufacturer's safety data sheet on 30% acetic acid and the fact that it'll send you to the hospital and you may lose your sight permanently. That's something you want to know before you go and purchase a product and use it. So Pesticides are sold without appropriate information in many cases from the staff, but the label's on there. It tells you everything you need to know. End rant.
Hey, Don, what's a grapefruit? What's a pomelo? Are they the same thing?
They're closely related. A grapefruit is thought to have occurred as a natural hybrid between two other citrus in Jamaica, I believe it occurred. You bring citrus trees into proximity and they hybridize pretty readily. They also mutate pretty readily. It is thought that the grapefruit is a cross between a pomelo and another, and an orange or tangerine, actually, or mandarin. So it has the flavor constituents of both. Pomelo is more primitive than a grapefruit. And if you've ever had one, they're fun, they're interesting. They look like a giant grapefruit. And you'll see them in the grocery store at times. Nugget Market in Davis frequently has the Chandler pomelo or pumelo available for purchase. They're a little challenging because they're like a grapefruit, but you have to peel them twice. So you peel off the very thick outer peel, and then inside is something that looks like a grapefruit, but it's in tough segments. So you have to peel off the segment part, and then you find this amazingly delicious, tangy, sweet, but slightly bitter fruit. It has all the characteristics of a grapefruit, and that slight bitterness is one characteristic of grapefruits that some people don't like. A lot of kids don't like grapefruits. Pomelo is like that, but tends to be sweeter and less tangy than an actual grapefruit. Just to confuse things, pomelos have been crossed with grapefruits, and one of the best grapefruits, quote unquote, that you'll see in the grocery store and at garden centers is Oro Blanco, which is a grapefruit pomelo hybrid. So it's a little sweeter than most grapefruits. It doesn't have the bitterness that we get in Northern California in grapefruits. You don't get that as much in grapefruits from the Rio Grande Valley, Texas, Arizona. They just have such a long, sunny, hot season that their grapefruits are sweeter. It's true. And sweeter than true grapefruits grown in Northern California. Pomelos have the sweetness. They have less of the bitterness. This hybrid is intermediate and one of the best for home gardeners in Northern California. Oro Blanco, cross between a pomelo and a grapefruit, usually sold as a grapefruit. If you got room, pomelos are fun trees. I have one that's 10 years old, and in a good year, it's producing 15 or 20 fruit. They're gigantic, so you don't need that many, but they're kind of a hassle to eat. So if you're limited for space, I probably wouldn't plant a pomelo, but if you like grapefruits, look for Oro Blanco or one of the red versions like Rio Red, which is a very good one for Northern California as well.
So the Davis Garden Show is broadcast and streamed live on Thursdays at noon, and That's Life, that's my show, is now broadcast and streamed live Tuesday at noon, okay. The replay Wednesdays at 5 p.m. And okay. Of course, all of the shows for all of us are available as archives on kdrt.org. So we end the show usually with a quote. And thank you to Gaina, I have a book full of quotes, but then I also make them up. So anyway, I don't know who this one came from. I found it a while ago and I really like it. And here we go. Learn from other people's mistakes. You don't have time to make them all yourself.
That's an excellent gardening quote. You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore
and Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.